podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you enjoy the show and would like to become a sponsor, please head over to the Patreon page, patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. For as little as $1 a month, you can help out and receive a Fisheries Podcast sticker in the mail. For $10 a month, you'll receive a Fisheries Podcast hat, sticker, and be the official sponsor of The Final Questions. And for $20 a month, you'll receive all of the merch, plus you'll be the official sponsor of each episode's guest or interview. Please remember, regardless of if you become a sponsor or not, we greatly appreciate you listening to the show. I'm super excited about today's episode because I'll be talking to Dr. Clive Truman. He's currently an associate professor of marine ecology at the University of Southampton in the UK. Clive grew up in the countryside in the south of England and went to Bristol to do a degree in geology. He then stayed in Bristol to do his PhD in what's called geochemical taphonomy of vertebrate assemblages, or as he told me, paleoforensics for dinosaurs. He then headed to the Smithsonian for a postdoc fellowship working with K. Barensmeyer, an absolute legend in the field of vertebrate taphonomy, and Noreen Toros, who is equally legendary in archaeological biogeochemistry. That took him to Washington, D.C., as well as Kenya, to work on human evolution in sites in the Rift Valley. In 2001, he went from Washington, D.C. to Israel for another postdoc at the Weizmann Institute with another really inspirational mentor, Steve Weiner. There, he continued looking at what happens to bones after they die, but also started working on scientific archaeology, basically taking instruments out to dig sites, places like Gath, the hometown of Goliath. He finally says he dragged himself back to the UK in 2004 for a lectureship at the University of Portsmouth, where he started looking at stable isotopes in fishes. In 2008, he then moved to the University of Southampton and has been there ever since. Welcome to the podcast, Clive. I'm really excited to be talking to you, in part for personal reasons. We seem to be two of maybe five or so people in the world who are currently trying to interpret the stable isotopes in fish eye lenses, and I hope we get to talk about that some. I've also followed you on Twitter for the past year or so, and I've learned a lot from the information and papers that you post and retweet. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I'm really interested to hear more about your background and philosophy when it comes to using chemical ecology for fishery science.
Thanks very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I'm excited to try and share anything that I can. I'm kind of aware that given that the bio that you just read out, that I am a slight fraud when it comes to this podcast, because Now, my background is very definitely not in fish and fisheries. It's more a testament of somebody who can't focus and gets distracted by shiny things. And I just flitted around. So it's very nice to be able to talk about how I've kind of got there from here with no real plan, and it's all just fallen in the way it has. But looking backwards, you can draw a thread through it. So I'll try and do that a little bit, and then I will, honestly, I promise I will talk a little bit about fishes as well.
That is actually one of the things that I think is most interesting and exciting. I'm a little bit of a flitter, probably, maybe not quite as strongly as your career trajectory, but I moved around to various types of things, and I just think that's really exciting and interesting. So you studied dinosaurs. I think this is probably a first for the Fisheries Podcast. When did you first get interested in paleontology, and what got you involved in it?
Oh, how can you not be interested in paleontology? Especially, how can you not be interested in paleontology as a kid? And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about kids later as well. But yeah, I mean, it's you can't not. So I was excited about fossils and that kind of thing right from early age. My dad lived on or came from the Isle of Wight, which is a little island on the south coast of the UK. So we used to go there on holidays, and I think as a small child, found my first ammonite there. And that's it. You find a fossil. And for me, it was a big fossil. It must have been the size of my head. You find a fossil, and that's it. At that age, you're very susceptible to being inspired or being excited by something that's not what you do every day. And that did it. So at that stage, I loved fossils and rocks and things, and that stayed with me. I kind of knew that I wanted to do something about fossils and rocks. So that got me into into geology. So that then led me into doing a geology degree and thinking about what you can do with rocks and fossils. And I should say, in between my childhood and doing a degree, I absolutely sucked at chemistry, really badly, and I just hated it. And geology is one of those sciences where a lot of it is going out into the field and looking at stuff and describing it. And it was a science that didn't need you to be particularly quantitative at the time, and so that appealed to me. It appealed to me that you could look at things and interpret them and describe them, but you didn't necessarily have to write equations about them, because at that stage in my life, that was not where I was. I studiously avoided all of the courses that involved chemistry as much as I could. And then sort of by the end of my, really at the end of my undergraduate, I was growing up a little bit, which is shameful. I started to understand that actually you could use chemistry as a way of describing things rather than a way of just writing equations and understanding the chemistry itself. That was a bit of a revelation to me, that chemistry was a way of describing how things work rather than just a process. And then that kind of got me into the idea of using chemistry to study fossils. And if you're going to use chemistry to study fossils, you get to choose which fossils you're going to study. Well, it might as well be dinosaurs. I got a PhD, kind of wrote a PhD subject for myself that was looking at the chemistry of dinosaur bones, trying to figure out what you could say about what happened to them after the animal died based on the chemistry, based on how those bones changed after death. And that was super. So I got to basically go, nobody else was doing it, so I got to go wherever I wanted to go, at least as long as I could afford it, and go and dig up dinosaur bones and crush them, which actually also suited me, because my temperament is not really very well suited to sitting very carefully and excavating things very beautifully, and people who really do paleontology properly are supremely patient and wonderful people who can excavate these exquisite and delicate fossils. I can't do that. I can pick up a rock and crush it, and that's pretty much my patience levels. So this was ideal. I got to go out and hang out in the badlands of Montana and Alberta and find dinosaurs, dig up the bones, but not actually have to do the hard work of digging them really carefully. I could just take a chunk and take it back and crush it and measure its chemistry. And that was great. I really enjoyed doing that. So that kept me going for quite a long time and took me to Montana, to Alberta. I went to Africa, went to Tunisian Sahara. Yeah, all over.
You've been to so many different places. It's really amazing. What do you think is your favorite memory from all the places that you've worked in?
That's very hard. It's not any particular individual memory. It's more the feeling of being out in a camp and, you know, getting up crazy early and it's sunny. It's, you know, it's going to be roastingly hot and you don't know what you're going to find. But most of all, it's just different. It's not your daily thing. It's doing something that's unusual. And all of your senses are kind of heightened because it's new and exciting. That feeling of uncertainty and discovery and promise when you wake up that morning and you don't know what you're going to do, that's priceless. So yeah, that's my best memory of doing that kind of work. And actually, it's the same in other different things in my career later on. It's always the new thing, the unusual thing, the thing that makes that really heightens up your senses. You see everything more clearly, you hear everything better, just because it's all new and it's all exciting. That's the best.
You were talking earlier about how you learned that, you know, chemistry could be useful. When I started my PhD using stable isotopes, I barely knew what a stable isotope even was. I could identify 200 different species of fish, but really know how all this stable isotope stuff worked. And now I'm so excited about how you can use the chemistry to really describe all of these different characteristics and movements and all these types of things. So it's really, really interesting.
So for like the majority of normal people, never really think about how the activities that you engage in as a person, as an animal, the expression that leaves in the chemistry of your tissues. Like, we don't, well, why would we think about that? But actually, everything we do has a chemical legacy. So wherever we are, whatever we eat, it's got some expression in the way that our body acquires different kinds of chemicals, processes them, lays them down in different tissues. And if you've got enough understanding of exactly what's happening, then that's a code that's there to crack. It's not an easy code to crack necessarily, but it's it's interesting. And it's one of the things that keeps me interested in science in general is trying to find new ways of measuring things that shouldn't be possible to measure. And chemistry gives you a whole range of new isotopes, new elements, different systems to try and do that with. It lets your imagination run. You can think of a new question and try and find a chemical system that'll let you target that. Or maybe somebody comes up with a new way of measuring a different kind of element and, what could I do with that? That's fun. That's interesting. So chemistry gives you all of these different windows into studying aspects of behavior and ecology that might otherwise be really difficult or really expensive to do. It doesn't really matter if it's fish or birds or frogs or people. It all works the same way. So if you can sort of understand something basic about how an animal's biology or an animal's ecology or an animal's behavior is going to have a chemical expression, then you can use those tools to unlock all kinds of behaviors, all kinds of insights into different animal systems. So you have lots of opportunity then to study whatever you want and to take yourself into interesting places and ask exciting questions.
What made you make the switch from dinosaurs and people to fish specifically?
I spent quite a few years on the paleontology side, and it was very enjoyable. But I got to a point where I was writing grants, and I was struggling to convince myself that the questions I was trying to answer were really worth answering. I was struggling to say that this was the best possible use of, you know, taxpayers' grant funding money. And if I couldn't do that, then I didn't think I was going to be the most convincing person to write a grant. That doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile science. It's just I wasn't the right person to write those grants at the time. So I kind of made a pretty conscious decision that I had to start doing something that was dealing with modern problems, dealing with the major issues that are facing all manner of natural ecosystems now. And it's all very well to, you can say that if we study things in the past, we'll understand more about how they face threats in the future. And I didn't feel that I was really doing that. But yeah, I made a fairly conscious decision that I should start looking at modern animals and trying to say something about what are they doing? Is there anything we can understand about the way modern animals are behaving that gives us some more information to conserve them, manage them, understand them better?
I definitely understand that perspective. I was always a kid who was really, really into the marine environment, wanting to, you know everything about the ocean and that sort of thing. Like a lot of kids who are into that stuff, I started off, you know, really excited about dolphins and whales and all those things. And then I realized that when I got introduced to fisheries, I was like, wow, this is actually immediately impactful. The information that we are gathering is things that we can use to make decisions to maintain these populations. And it's just so applied and so exciting to really have those kind of immediate impacts. And so I totally understand that perspective.
It's a real skill to be able to turn science into something that can be used by policy. I struggle with that. I'm not very good at actually writing or designing the science and communicating the science in such a way that it's immediately useful to the people who actually are making decisions and enacting them in the field. So that really just amazing respect for the people who can do both. Who can do the science really well, but also can translate that into something that's actually practically useful for the people on the ground. I'm struggling with trying to do that.
I guess in the case of isotope ecology, I'm still a little hopeful rather than practical on that particular front. I think it has so much promise. You mentioned that you had a lot of really inspiring mentors. How do you think that's shaped your mentorship style and how you interact with younger or less experienced scientists?
I couldn't possibly hope to be as inspirational as the people that I got to work with. I mean, Kay Behrensmar and Noreen Toros, just amazing people to work with. They were sort of intellectual kind of an academic powerhouses, but also maybe not initially approachable. As soon as you actually got to know them, just supportive and you respected the fact that they supported you. No, they were fabulous people. So I'd like to hope that I carry out some of what I learned from being in their labs and being sort of around them all the time. it's very hard to create exactly the right environment. Now that I'm in a position where I'm kind of running a lab and I have a fair number of PhD students, and you have to think about how you communicate with them. What's your job? What's your role as a lab head? I don't have enough time to do it properly. And I'd like to be spending much more time having, you know, lab social events and lab meals out and that whatever's cultivate the lab culture is something that I definitely do miss that. So I hope I've taken the supportive and approachable lessons that I learned from my mentors.
I mean, I think the other side of the coin is really that you have to remember that scientists are people too. Everybody's a person, and yeah, people act like people no matter what.
Almost everybody is trying their best all the time. They really are. And particularly academic science, it's largely about rejection. You can't help it. It is largely about rejection. And it's easy to be upset and angry by the kinds of rejections you get, whether it's a paper or a job offer or a grant. It took me a long time to learn not to be angry by those. That everybody, people who are rejecting your ideas or your science, some science has to be rejected. There is a limited amount of space. And equally, nobody has necessarily the time to tell you exactly why that got rejected in the most constructive way possible. You can approach that rejection in different ways. And if you can bring yourself to approach that rejection with a thought that, well, that person is busy. They've tried to help my science, and I need to take a deep breath and read that constructively, even if the way it's been written doesn't make it easy. And it's taken me a while to recognize or to believe that everybody is really generally doing their best.
Your current research program is mostly investigating fish, correct?
Almost exclusively. There's a little bit of birds and whales that creep in there.
What sorts of questions is your lab looking into right now?
Three broad areas. A lot of people looking at using stable isotopes in fish and fisheries research. It's typically about looking at trophic level and diet interactions. So we do a little bit of work in there, and that's based on the idea that isotopic composition of an animal's tissue is linked or is similar to the isotopic composition of the food that it eats, but there's a small change in that isotopic composition as you go up the food web. And we can use those isotopic differences to track trophic interactions within food webs and to track the flux of nutrients from different sources through food webs. So that's probably the most kind of popular use of isotopes. And we do a little bit of that, but most of the work that we're doing in our lab at the moment is involved with spatial aspects. So trying to reconstruct movements and migrations of fishes based on linking the isotopic composition of their tissues to some kind of prediction or model or map of how isotopes vary in the environment. And we're trying to use that basic movement ecology and connectivity between different life stages of different animals. But we're also looking at it from a fisheries traceability perspective. So can you take the isotopic composition of a fish muscle in a fillet or in a traded fish product? And can you use that to try and verify or validate the origin that's stated on a packet or an origin that a fish is sold? We don't have very many tools at the moment to test whether geographic labeling is actually correct or not. And so that's something we're working on quite heavily to try and use isotopes to help us with.
Seems like a really, really interesting area, and especially applicable because, like you say, it is difficult to know whether the labels are correct and really get information about the traceability of these species that are bought and sold.
Yeah, and especially as management is largely spatially based with potentially different quota rules, different landing obligations, different size landing obligations in different jurisdictions, then knowing exactly where something's come from can be a source of mislabeling or a source of flouting some of the management implied rules. So where there's a lack of clarity in the food chain, And genetics has done a fantastic job of identifying when there's been species mislabeling or species substitution. You know, those genetic markers are not necessarily going to be very good at identifying different populations, particularly in species that are quite mobile and intermixed. And that's where hopefully we can help. We may not be able to get it to the kind of forensic accuracy and precision levels that you might need to take something to court for a prosecution, but you might be able to get things to a level where you could identify if there's potentially a problem here that somebody might want to investigate in more detail with other methods.
I find that actually one of the great things about stable isotopes in general is that it can be combined with a lot of other types of data and used as another piece of evidence, I think.
One of its aspects, when you work on tools that take quite a lot of time to master, like stable isotopes or genetics or trace elements, or it takes a long time to master those, and you don't necessarily have time to be an expert in more than one field. And there's a danger that that's all you do. And you think, right, isotopes are going to answer my question and only isotopes. But if you can collaborate with the people who are experts in the other fields, in genetics or in morphology or whatever, that's when it becomes really so much more powerful.
Yours has been one of two labs that I know of pioneering the use of fish eye lenses as stable isotopes as a means of understanding movement and diet. How did you decide to explore this avenue?
You're always looking for some kind of tissue that's going to give you a different insight into the life history of your animal, thinking about otoliths. And the first work I did with fishes was actually on Atlantic salmon, using the isotopes and scales of Atlantic salmon to try and reconstruct marine feeding areas. So I started doing that back in 2004, and I still haven't anywhere near finished doing that. That was already starting to look at, well, how can you go back in time in the life of an individual fish? And in scales, you can't, it turns out, because of just the geometry of the way the scale grows. It doesn't allow you to go back in time with stable isotopes. Otoliths, of course, we all love otoliths as those incredible biochronometers, beautiful records of growth history right throughout the life of a fish. And you can make these fantastic trace element measurements and records of, for instance, when animals move from high salinity to low salinity waters, it's recorded faithfully in the strontium-calcium ratios of the otolith. And these are beautiful traces of animal movement. But the otolith is a mineral. It doesn't have very much, has some, but doesn't have very much organic tissue or organic components. And that means for us, people trying to use the stable isotopes of carbon or nitrogen and sulfur, the otolith isn't really there for us. We don't have that chronological record, that life history record that the otolith gives to everybody else. So we're always sort of searching around for a tissue that grows from birth or from hatching from the egg and continuously grows throughout the life of the animal. That's where lenses can come in. Bronwyn Gelanders and colleagues in Australia have been looking at eye lenses as a record, another record of trace element information. And it kind of concluded that the eye lens was promising, but actually difficult to work with. But that made it clear that there was something there, that the lenses grow incrementally. And the eye lens, you have to take the cells out. I mean, you can't have cellular tissue inside the eye lens, or it's going to diffract light and it won't work in the right way. So if you've taken all the cellular material out of the lens proteins, then it can't be remodeled and it's going to stay there for the whole life of the fish. So we have a tissue that's growing as the fish is growing, and it can't be changed after it's been deposited. So those are really the two criteria that we need to have, or a record of the chemistry of the animal as it's been growing. And the eye lens is made of protein, so that means it's carbon and nitrogen and also sulfur that's there for us to exploit isotopically. Then you come to the idea of all the practicalities. Okay, it should work. How do I physically handle an eye lens? And we spent so long trying to treat an eye lens like an otolith. So we spent an awfully long time trying to find ways of sectioning an eye lens. And
wouldn't that be nice?
Isn't it hard? Isn't it unbelievably hard? And it shouldn't be. You'd think, come on, there's got to be a way of picking hold of the spherical protein. Looks like a marble. Surely you can embed this in some resin, or maybe you can stick some needles in it and cut it. But my goodness me, it's hard. I think we spent 2 years trying various different methods and mechanisms to embed and to basically treat an eye lens like an otolith, and totally gave up. So in the end, we do the same thing that I think most labs are doing. And we're peeling them like an onion. It seems to work pretty well that you can peel the layers, the sequential layers of protein off of the eye lens with care, and some lenses easier than others, and build a sort of concentric layer of a concentric record of the proteins that the fish was laying down at different points in its life. And from that, record the isotope, the isotope ratios of carbon and nitrogen that the fish was laying down as it was growing its eyes. And so from that, yes, we can build these records of, or these interpretive records, where we can infer what an animal was doing, what a fish was doing, particularly in the early juvenile phases where its lenses are growing really fast and it's putting on tissue quite rapidly. And of course, those early life stages in a fish context are the things that we really care about, because that's where we have the high mortality. It's where changes in mortality are going to have big impacts in population sizes. Also, the sizes of fish where it's hard to put tags on them. So if we're wanting to look at movement, we don't have very many other alternatives. Technology associated with telemetry gets better and better, and the tags get smaller and smaller. We're still not in a position where we can instrument a whole bunch of larval fish, but they're growing their lenses for us, tagging themselves. I think there's a huge potential, and I'm excited that lots of people are doing it now, or more people. Still not lots, is it? But more people are doing it.
So I think this is going to be my last career question. If you had unlimited funding, what direction would you like to go in? What would you like to investigate next?
One of my answers to that would be unlimited amount of money, then acoustic arrays everywhere. Oceanic acoustic arrays. Stick them on fixed moorings, stick them on buoys, cover the whole ocean.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Both coasts of Florida are covered in arrays.
Yeah, no, they're springing up everywhere. And so I was thinking that would be an amazing thing to do, and be able to sort of instrument lots of individual fish and really find out where they go and what they do. Part of me really doesn't want that to happen. Like the non-scientific part of me thinks that actually what's exciting about what makes us really love fish is the mystery. It's the fact that you don't actually know. You don't really know exactly what they're doing. That's part of what makes them so much fun and makes them so exciting and so kind of alluring. And I you know, the scientist in me says, yeah, we need to know what they're doing. And the human in me doesn't actually want to know everything about what they do. I want them to still be mysterious. Yeah. So unlimited money, yeah, that would be a great thing to do. But it would take a little bit of the romance or the excitement out of fish. So I'm glad it's not going to happen immediately.
I would be on the field team to deploy and retrieve those. One of the things that I wanted to stress in the fisheries podcast is scientists are also humans and three-dimensional. Scientifically, you seem like a pretty busy guy with a pretty full research schedule. Do you have outside interests that you enjoy when you aren't working?
Well, yes, although they've taken something of a backseat. So family, we'll come on to that. That's pretty much all of my spare time now is children related. But other than that, it's music, guitars. I'm absolutely frustrated musician. When I do have any time that isn't work and isn't children, it would be guitars.
Do you ever play in public?
Well, I did, but that has not happened for a long time. Yeah, no, the amount of time it takes to be able to play to a level, practice and keep your skills to a level that you wouldn't be really embarrassed. Yeah, definitely not. You can make up for some of that with volume, but not entirely.
Yeah, so you've mentioned the kids. I think that your children and my son are in similar age brackets. My son is 3. How old are your kids?
So my eldest, Calvin, he's going to be 6 in March, and then Meredith is 3. So yeah, it's full on, right?
It's something.
Yeah, it really.
Mine has recently decided that sleep is for the birds, and he's not going to do it anymore.
Well, so Calvin just didn't sleep for the first 2 years at all. So now it's better. It's better, but it's still kind of night by night. Who knows? Calvin's great now, but Meredith's taken up the candle.
Three is something.
Yeah.
So much fun, but also just a lot.
Yes. And you don't know, you don't understand quite what it's like, quite how all encompassing it is until you have them. So, and I had mine pretty relatively late-ish, so sort of in my early 40s when Calvin came along. So I had the luxury of building up a kind of comfortable career beforehand, which puts me in a nice, you know, an easy position. But doing it, having children without that stability, hard, man.
I was approximately the same age. I turned 40 when my kid was 6 months old, but I was not smart enough to build up a stable career beforehand. I've done a lot of different things since college and all in the marine world, but that doesn't give you a stable career at all. So, but I will have to say that being a grad student with a baby was actually a very good arrangement, just because of the absolute freedom of, you know, schedule for a graduate student was really incredible. Now that he's three and, you know, wants all of my mental energy, it's more difficult.
Yeah, and there's the frustration of like, I've only got half an hour free.
Right.
This was something that was, I really noticed in doing a postdoc in Israel, where firstly it was quite nice being in a lab that was, you know, very female oriented, which was unusual because I'd been working in geology until then, which is really not that way. But also it was absolutely expected that a large proportion of PhDs will be having kids while they're doing their PhDs, and that was the norm.
Wow.
And it sort of worked, right? Everybody just expected it and it worked.
I can't even
and
imagine.
I'd never really understood why it's kind of weird outside of that environment. Everywhere else I've been, it's, what, you're going to have a kid? Yeah, it shouldn't be that way.
What do you think is the most challenging thing about being an academic parent to young children?
So apart from the chronic sleep deprivation, which just deprives you of all ability to concentrate. I got to a point with Calvin that I was one day at my desk and I physically could not read. I could see words on a paper and I could not comprehend them. It took me, and I got actually kind of freaked out about that and went for a walk, and still it took about an hour before I could actually remember how to read. That freaked me out massively. And then after that, luckily at that point, Calvin started actually sleeping, but we'd been nearly 2 years with no more than 2 hours sleep a night. That was unbelievable. So that level of chronic sleep deprivation and attempting to function, that's challenging. Now, actually, the most challenging thing is, like, you suddenly realize how the academic kind of world is structured on being available to go and do meetings, go and do conferences, go and do field work. And if you can't do that, if you've got, you know, you've got a partner that works, that can't take time off here, there, and everywhere, that's really hard to do. I pretty much have given up on most conferences and given up on most scientific travel, at least until they're considerably older. And that definitely impacts your career a bit.
I have had similar challenges as I'm transitioning out of being a PhD student into trying to get a job in the workforce. I've been established in my city for 15 years. My husband has a job. Are we going to move to someplace totally different for a 2-year postdoc? Or am I going to find something to do here that isn't academic?
And I think there's also part of the not the most healthy culture associated with academia can be that you have to be in a university to get a PhD, right? That training in, but you have to have a PhD to kind of, in many cases, you're supposed to have a PhD to be trained to be a scientist. So we're training all of our scientists only in universities, and we're training them, and in that way, we're kind of training them by people like me who've only ever been in universities. So we kind of set people up that actually academia is the best way of doing science, or if you don't stay in academia, you somehow haven't done it the right, or you somehow failed. And that's nonsense. But it's there. It's there as a feeling, purely because the only place you can get a PhD And the only people who can supervise you to get a PhD are the people who have stayed in academia. So there is that sort of feeling that that's what a PhD is for, even though it's not. So I think that's a kind of difficult culture to get around.
What do you think is the most rewarding thing about being an academic parent to your young children?
Oh, well, you know, I can tell them about dinosaurs. I can get into the back of museums. I've been lucky. Like the career I've had, I've got so much stuff that I can talk about. So if they're prepared to listen to me, then I can tell them things. And I've done go into the school quite often and take stuff from the university here and take some bits of whales and bits of sharks and bits of dinosaurs. And for as long as they'll let me talk, I can kind of play with that. That's fabulous. That's a really nice thing to do. You're enthusiastic about finding stuff out, and that's the best thing that you can kind of translate or give to kids. Kids want to find stuff out as well. So you're on their level, right? You just want to find stuff out. So it's, you can connect with them as an academic. There are some things that are easy to do, some things that should be easy to do about being just excited about finding stuff out and helping them find stuff out. That's pretty good.
I definitely agree. What do you look forward to the most as your kids continue to grow up? What kinds of things are you looking forward to doing with them as they get bigger?
Oh, just forcing them outside more. Like it's pretty rainy and cold most of the time, so they've got an excuse. But yeah, just as they're more able to walk further and to just not complain as much, then showing them things, just showing them cool stuff that's outside, whether it's finding fossils or pointing or catching fish or just anything, just going to volcanoes.
You're going to visit volcanoes soon?
Going to Sicily, going. Wow. And a play at Etna. Yeah, that'll be great. Yeah, cool. Yeah, I've done quite a lot of volcano tourism, so try and find reasonable ways of doing that that's compatible with family life.
This is the part of the episode where I ask the guests the same closing questions. So I have three questions for you, and I'll start really simple. What is your favorite fish?
Yeah, you say that's simple, but you know that's not simple. I was going to go all kind of exotic and deep sea or something, but actually, No, it's the mackerel, the Atlantic mackerel, right? It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful fish, but also fantastically tasty and an incredible source of omega-3s. And, you know, it's still relatively cheap. So it's canned, it's sold. So pretty much anybody can afford it. And I was chatting to somebody in my med school, in my university, who was talking about recommendations of omega-3s or levels of eating oily fish once a week as our kind of national recommendations. Most people in Britain never eat oily fish. Actually, not once a week, never. And mackerel is one of the best sources. It's cheap, it's canned, you can preserve it, you buy it, it doesn't go off. How can you not love this fish that's beautiful? It's exciting. We don't know very much about how it sort of migrates and moves, but also it can feed people really cheaply in a way that doesn't get wasted, and it's an amazing source of omega-3s that people desperately need. So there you go. You can't not love it.
I'm sold. I'm going to buy some mackerel. What do you think your dream location would be?
Well, okay, so dream job and dream location is not necessarily the same thing. So dream job is actually a kind of successful professional guitarist, which is not going to happen. So outside of dream job, this is a pretty good second. It would be nice to be warmer. It would be nice to be on a warmer bit of sea. So, you know, you've got it sorted there. The institute I'm in now is pretty amazing in terms of the facilities and the people we have running the facilities. So it's hard to find. There is no perfect. You can look up the fence and see how green the grass is, but then you walk it and it's full of thistles and nettles and things. So I think it's safer to say what is good about the place you're in than what's the best place you could possibly be.
And finally, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
It is that people are trying their best. That's it. It's just people are genuinely trying their best. Give them a break. It'll just make life easier, everybody easier, if we all just understand that everybody's trying their best. Nothing tougher than that.
Thank you for listening to the 61st episode of the Fisheries Podcast. I do want to remind everyone about the Patreon page, and if you feel so inclined to help us out, head over to patreon.com/fisheriespodcast to become a sponsor and get some cool FishPod merch. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I'm Julie Vecchio, and thank you for listening to the 61st episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, everyone is trying their best. What should I call you?
Oh, what do you mean? Clive? Okay. That's good enough. But,
yeah. I don't know. What do your students call you?
I don't know. Let's not go there.